Lifeway Leadership Podcast Network.
Welcome back to the Group Answers Podcast. This is episode 84. I'm Brian Daniel with Chris Surratt. And Chris, the place is electric. We have Dr. Tony Morita on the line.
So exciting.
We have a live studio audience.
No, we don't.
And we are in January and looking forward to daylight savings.
That is exciting. You know, daylight savings is just a few more weeks away. But, you know, it's not my favorite time change. Fall is great because you get that hour extra. Yeah. But then you go to the next one and you lose an hour, but you get that light in the morning. So it's kind of a trade-off. I wish they would just leave it at that one, you know, and not do the fallback, but whatever.
I might be getting a little ahead of myself. We still have quite some winter to go, I think.
Depends on where you live.
Yeah. Welcome to the show, Tony.
Hey, man. Great to be with you guys.
So let me just say, if you, for those of you that are not familiar with Dr. Tony Morita, he is the founding pastor of Imago Dei Church in Raleigh, North Carolina. He also serves as associate professor of preaching at Southeastern Baptist Seminary in Wake Forest, North Carolina. Tony's books include Faithful Preaching, Orphanology, Ordinary, How to Turn the World Upside Down, Proclaiming Jesus, and eight volumes in the new Christ-Centered Exposition Commentary series with Broadman and Holman, of which he also serves as a general editor along with Danny Aiken and David Platt. I have read the Ephesians, one of those, and it was fantastic. Tony, from what you're saying, Exodus is the one you tend to get the most reaction to.
Yeah, for a variety of reasons. I think one of it's manageable. It's not a huge commentary, and Exodus can feel like a daunting book to work through, whether you're preaching it, teaching it, or just reading it on your own. And so, I tried to just identify some of the major units of thought and the theology within Exodus, and it seemed to be received pretty well.
Tony is happily married to Kimberly, and they have 5 adopted children. Not on this official bio is assistant baseball coach. Also not on this bio is the fact that Tony is the was a scholarship baseball player. Where was it? Cumberland College? Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct, wow, man.
And Chris, you would be happy to know that Tony is also from Kentucky.
Why, that would make you happy.
Well, I know you're partial to bluegrass.
I mean, I like Kentucky. It's a great state. I have never lived. I've driven two. That's great. I am excited about the baseball. I'm a huge baseball fan. We talk about baseball a lot. So, Tony, who's your team? Who's your major league team?
I think it's the Tigers. Is that right?
You got it, mate. Yeah. I was born in Detroit. My dad's born and raised Detroit.
So awesome.
I'm a Tiger fan by birth. I'm a Nats fan by marriage. So I've adopted the Nats when marrying Kimberly, and then moving to Raleigh, we're pretty close to the Nats. So we go watch them a lot. So it's helpful to have both American League and National League and not two teams in the same league, you know.
Chris, you're Astros guy?
Well, no, I'm same thing. I'm a Cardinals guy growing up in St. Louis, but then I married into the Astros. So it used to be Astros and Cardinals were in the same, you know, same division, and then they moved the Astros over the American League, which helped a lot in our household. You know, we can kind of root for both till they both meet in the World Series. But yeah, it's a good situation for us.
Well, that's interesting that you know, spent time in Houston, but you married into being an Astros guy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, once you're a Cardinals fan, you're gonna be a Cardinals fan for life. It just doesn't change because they're that good.
So Tony, you're a guy, you know, just looking at the resume and just the bio, that's pretty busy. And since I've known you, every time we talk, you're writing something. And you're also in the middle of a deadline even this week. So again, thanks for taking time out to be with us. You're a pastor, the father of a large family that's getting busier as you move into the teen years, and you know, you're taking on some of those responsibilities. You're a writer, a part-time coach, and until recently a college professor, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct.
So what counsel would you have for group leaders who are also trying to balance full-time jobs with family and significant ministry commitments?
Oh, wow, man. Well, that's the question I'm asking as well.
Fair enough.
I get that question a lot, and I don't have anything that would be, you know, out of the ordinary on getting a lot done, but I would just encourage people to work early, first of all. So if I didn't get started, you know, well before 7 o'clock on a normal day, I wouldn't get stuff done, especially writing. I get a lot of writing done, you know, before 8 o'clock even. And then smart work. So finding good rhythms, do advanced planning. That's an important part of my life, of looking at the calendar well in advance and getting organized. You know, I know how many words, for example, each chapter is going to take, how long each page normally takes in a commentary. And I just structure my calendar and build it in so that I can write. I got to work hard, you know, so when I'm working, really work. When I'm resting, really rest. And then I don't do anything alone. I've got a great team. So I would not do what I do without my wonderful bride, my team at the church. And then I think it's also important to build in times of rest, seasons for rest, so that we're not killing ourselves. And then kind of a heart issue on work is the idea of gratitude. I think that there's really no room for self-pity when I think about the kinds of jobs other people have in this world, that I should be really grateful that I get to do what I do. And to realize that Jesus has already done the most important work. And I can work with a sense of rest, even when I'm working hard, and a sense of joy, because Christ has accomplished what matters most, and he's coming to renew all things. So those are just, you know, some categories of thought that are in my mind. In addition, one last piece I would say is just to recognize that there are seasons in life that are going to require more work than other seasons, and just accept that. You can't be in that season all the time, but occasionally, you know, you got to be in beast mode and get stuff done. You can't stay in beast mode. You won't live long. But I think we tend to want balance, which I don't really care for that notion very well. I'm not trying to be balanced in terms of my proportion of time with all the stuff I'm doing. I tend to think more in terms of seasons and rhythms and just trying to identify what season I'm in. And there has to be a good rhythm, I think, of work, rest, and play, or we'll burn out and or not be very productive and produce good work.
That's good. Tony, I'm curious. I wasn't a morning person for a lot of my life. I was a musician, unless you counted like 2 o'clock in the morning as a morning person. But in the last several years, I've kind of adapted and grown into a morning person and start my day pretty early. And I've got routines that I've got to follow. What does your morning routine look like? You said you do a lot of writing. Are there other things that you have to do in the morning to kind of get your day going?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't necessarily like mornings. I can't stay awake late at night. The elders and staff make fun of me because if we're on a staff retreat, we watch a movie, I'm asleep in 10 minutes at night.
That's my life.
So it's really my body clock, you know? And so what I've described is not for everybody. You know, I know guys who write late at night, and I think you wear your own armor on this stuff, for the most part. For me though, I front load what's most important in the week. And so again, not everybody can do this, but I write for 8 hours every Monday. I don't go into the office and I turn in, I'm usually working on the following Sunday's sermon, and I turn in a rough draft on Monday by 5 o'clock to our staff. That's for accountability and for them to know kind of where I'm going during the course of the week. And that 8 hours is really important because I'm able to get about 70% of the sermon done. And it allows me to relax for the rest of the week. It allows me to then do more editing than writing. And I think that's the secret to good sermon prep, and the secret to good writing is good editing, not so much great writing, but having the time to edit. Mm-hmm. So Monday allows me to get that draft complete, and then I can edit during the week. Whereas I think when I first started doing ministry, I was preaching a first draft because I was waiting too long in the week to get the sermon developed. So I would just take that principle, whatever ministry you're in, you know, and think about how can I front load my prep so that I can fine tune it more than ride it toward the end of the week. And so for me, that usually involves getting up before six. Again, it's my body clock. I don't even set a clock. So I don't try necessarily to get up at a certain time, but I'm always up before six, and I try to spend 45 minutes or so just with the Lord, reading, praying, that sort of thing, make some coffee. And then I start writing, usually, unless there's some early morning meeting I got to be at or a hospital visit or something like that. And so by 8 o'clock, I try to, eat breakfast and, you know, I'll see the kids. I may continue riding at home or I may go to the office, depending on what the day looks like. And then go through my day. Exercise is important to me. So I go to the gym Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday. That's normally around 4 or 5 o'clock whenever the day is kind of over. And I don't work in the evening. I've never been really good at, you know, after dinner work. So I take a break. So I try to get up and work really hard when I'm at work. I try not to look at my phone, you know, up until about lunchtime, you know, with a few exceptions. I just try to lock in, you know, when I'm working. They call me Task Mode Tony, because sometimes my wife can't even get my attention when I'm in task mode. And I think that ability to kind of lock in is very important because people just are prone to get very distracted and try to multitask, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So I either got to be all in or not. So that's a little bit of what it looks like.
That's good. Yeah. Multitasking I found is a myth. You can't really do anything well if you're multitasking. Mm-hmm. So that's really good. I want to ask you about your book, Ordinary, that is for the most part about hospitality. And I know that's one of your passion points. I love that. I just wrote a little book with a chapter on gospel-centered hospitality, and it was a fascinating study for me. Mm-hmm. But what events or circumstances in your life have pushed that practice of hospitality to such a prominent position in your family's personal lives?
Yeah, a great question. And it is a subject that I love. In fact, I almost wanted to write the entire book on hospitality in Ordinary. And looking back, I almost wish I would have, because I got most excited about that chapter and probably get the most feedback from it. And I think it's one of the things hospitality does for people, I think, is it allows them to recognize that they can do something very significant within the ordinary rhythm of their life. That they don't have to go on a mission trip, though that's fine and good in most cases. They don't even have to leave their neighborhood. You know, it's really about transforming that which is ordinary, that which we're already doing, into something that is a display of God's kingdom, of the character of Christ, of the grace He's shown us in welcoming us into His home, as it were, to His table. And so I think in America with kind of this individualized Western privatized world we live in, with, you know, back fences and no front porches, and, you know, you can now even check yourself out at the grocery store. You can go through a lot of your day and not talk to a human being. I think that's a problem. You know, other cultures are very communal, and they do hospitality just by nature. They don't always do it well, though, because I did a conference in Italy, and they wanted me to talk about hospitality. And I was like, you guys are the best. You hang out for hours, you know. But they're like, yeah, but it's only with our tribe. It's only with our families. It's only with those like us. And gospel-centered hospitality, you know, is pushing us to beyond just the familial and just our friends. It's saying, is there the, you know, a snotty-nosed kid down the street who is functionally fatherless that needs to be welcomed? Is there a widow nearby? Is, you know, how can you use what God has given you, your home, as a means of ministry? And it doesn't have to look like shock and awe, you know, to make an impact in the kingdom. It can be very ordinary acts and very ordinary meals, even. It doesn't have to be expensive or elaborate, because hospitality is really about serving people and not impressing people. So that concept has been super important for our family and super important for our church. I often say our church has grown primarily through hospitality, through our people having barbecues, inviting people over, you know, seeking to befriend people in their school system or, you know, the gym or where they shop, just paying attention to the people that God has placed in their networks and then inviting them into their lives and into their homes, and beginning a relationship with them that hopefully will lead them to Christ. So yeah, it's I could talk about it for the whole podcast. It's something that really does charge me up.
So Tony, just taking what you just said regarding hospitality and applying it to group life, as you and Kimberly have practiced hospitality as an important aspect of your ministry, what have you learned about hosting as a part of even disciple making? You mentioned you know, the child down the street. What other expressions do you have that you could share?
Yeah, well, one just principle that I keep putting before people, it's the same kind of principle in orphan care, is that it's warfare. You know, hospitality is not, if you're looking at kind of kingdom-minded hospitality and not just, again, inviting your friends over, they may ruin your furniture. They may steal from you. You know, like there are a lot of things that can happen. Like, but it's not the path of least resistance. And you have to surrender what many people, honestly, I think have made an idol, and that is their home. You know, they even call it their refuge. And we just said to our church, don't ever say that. Like, Jesus is our refuge. And we should be asking, what can use everything I have, you know, that you've given me to advance the gospel, including my home. And a lot of people's homes are simply not baptized. You know, they're off limits. So I think you got to be wise. I'm not saying to not be wise about hospitality, but you've got to realize it is a sacrifice and it is a challenge. And so we've welcomed folks in who've been victims of some form of abuse or slavery. We've been a home of respite care to particular places where workers are devoting all their time and energy to caring for those who've been oppressed. We've got folks in our church who are doing Safe Families, which is, again, respite care for vulnerable children. You know, then you kind of work your way up to foster care. Guys who've gotten out of prison. There are a number of ways that people in our church have been trying to reach out to neighbors. I think when it comes to group life, I mean, there's a great point to be made about community doing hospitality. So sometimes introverts get very nervous about hospitality. And I always say, you don't have to do hospitality by yourself. You can do it as a community. And, you know, in group life, welcoming people into community is, I would say, vitally important to winning people to faith, because some people need to see how the gospel works before they actually understand the gospel. They need to see what a community looks like that forgives one another, that is generous, that reconciles. And so I've found that a lot of unbelievers are more attracted to the Christian community than the Christian message at first. And, you know, once they see the community at work, then they're led, their heart is warmed, and they're led to the Savior who's provided as ultimate hospitality. So I think it's one thing for a group to do things like accountability, you know, that has to be sort of guarded and some real in-depth, you know, life on life discipleship stuff. But I think there should also be a sense of openness and welcome of those who are outsiders. So there are various ways to work that out depending on one's location and one's context.
That's so good. I mean, hospitality is the love of stranger, right? So I don't know a better place to do that than in community, in group life, welcoming in those that need it, even if they don't know that. So that's so good. Before we move on with Tony, I want to let you know about an event that's coming up that you might want to be a part of. We're part of the Lifeway Leadership Podcast Network, and they're putting on an event in March in Orange County, California. Lifeway Leadership is hosting a much-needed church leadership event that's all about leading change. If you know you need to lead change but are not sure where to start, this event is for you. Different than other leadership conferences, you'll spend most of your time in a group of less than 50 other leadership leaders discovering how to implement change in your church. And to make sure that every church leader leaves with a personalized plan for change, they're capping the event at 300. So if you know you need to lead change but are not sure where to start, then make sure to register for Blueprint Coaching in Orange County, California on March 14th through the 15th. Just go to lifeway.leadership.com/events to learn more about it. I want to ask you, Tony, research shows that Bible engagement is the indicator for a growing disciple that makes disciples. So what have you found to be the most effective way to teach the Bible to new believers?
Well, I would say teach it well.
It's a good
start. I think there's some basic skills, you know, in communicating. So I'm an advocate of expository preaching, of in-depth, you know, preaching, not exclusively through books of the Bible, but largely through books of the Bible. But I think that the danger of guys who adopt the philosophy is that they begin to teach in such a way that they assume everybody knows what's going on. They tend to kind of appeal to the Christian subculture, and their teaching is not very accessible. And so one of the things I've tried to do, and I usually do this toward the end of the week, I look at my sermon and I ask myself the question, would my old self have understood what I'm preaching here? And by old self, I mean like my newly converted college, you know, I was a sophomore in college when I became a Christian, and I was hungry. I wanted to learn, but I did not know. I didn't even know where the books of the Bible were. You know, like I needed somebody to make the teaching understandable. I was willing to go deep, but I needed somebody to help me. And so I just think there's a lot of preaching that does have substance, but it's not bridging the two worlds between the then and there and the here and now. And it's not taking consideration for the people in the back of the line who are in the church services. And so I think there's a way to do both. I don't think you have to sacrifice substance in order to reach, you know, people who have very little understanding of the Bible. I just think you got to teach it well and be mindful that they're aware, they're present. And I think in trying to engage intentionally unbelievers, new Christians, people with a different worldview, I think you're doing something else, and that's indirectly equipping your people on you're more discipled people, how to engage their friends. And I think what will happen is they will begin to bring their friends because you've developed a culture in your church, in your teaching that says, hey, we want people who are illiterate of the Bible or who are new Christians, who are not even Christians. So I think there are places in the sermon that you need to be really intentional about speaking directly to those particular audiences and not just your core people. So,
and Tony is referring to a sermon, but I think the same can be said for any given group discussion, you know, for group leaders out there, that you need to be mindful and not make assumptions about where everyone is on even something as basic as just their understanding of the Bible and how it's laid out.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I love that thought of thinking about it as your old self. You know, where were you and what did you need in that moment? I love that. For group leaders, I'm going to start teaching that. Just think about, as you teach through, you know, a passage of scripture, how would you have looked at that, you know, when you were a new believer?
Which shouldn't be that hard. We should be in touch with that person every bit as much as we're in touch with our new self, because that's where we came from. I mean, it's dead and gone away, but that's grace. You need to, you know, I think it's a discipline to remember grace in that context as who we once were. Mm-hmm. So Tony and everyone, you know, we're a group show, so that tends to drive our content, but the heartbeat of what we do is discipleship and disciple making. And so Tony, you're a senior pastor, but I think it would be interesting to know about your relationship with the group's ministry at Imago Dei. To what extent are you involved with this part of ongoing ministry at the church in the group's capacity?
Yeah, so I'm not, obviously not the discipleship pastor over, you know, dealing with the nuts and bolts, but we do sermon-based small groups at our church. Our church is a church plant. We're about 7.5 years old, and we've done sermon-based groups from the jump. And we actually had groups before we had a worship service. So we really believe in kind of this life-on-life discipleship around the word together in community. And so what that has done to my preaching is a number of things. Knowing that individuals are going to be discussing, not so much the sermon, I don't like sermon-based small groups, it's more the text, because they're not in there evaluating my sermon, or at least that's not the goal. The goal is for them to get around the text and to then chase cross-references that I may or may not have alluded to. We give questions, 8 to 10 questions. We have a team that form questions from the sermon. My sermon normally goes out to about a dozen people on Wednesday, and then they're taking the sermon and fleshing it out into more application based questions. And so, and this is also, by the way, one of the reasons I could teach through a large book of the Bible like Exodus in about 18 weeks, because I don't feel the burden necessarily to uncover every stone in the text, knowing that they're going to talk more about this text or this portion of Exodus in their groups. And so it's given me, I think it's built some cohesion in our church. It keeps everybody on the same page. Now, that's not all we do in small groups. You know, we have a place for classes and videos and other kinds of training, student ministry, that sort of thing. But the sermon-based aspect has definitely kept me engaged with group life. And then the other classes and other avenues for teaching, we do book clubs for men and women, that sort of thing. Those are also very much part of the pastoral discussion that we're having with one another. Hey, I think we really need to reemphasize this. So I think we should consider this book, or we really need our students to be thinking about this. So let's think about that. So even down to the curriculum, you know, I'm involved in those conversations.
I love how involved you are. It's so important for a senior pastor to know what's going on and have a, you know, heartbeat of what's happening in their groups. If it's an important part of your discipleship process and path, then the senior leader needs to be plugged into that. That's so, so good. I want to point out another podcast that's on our network. We're, again, a part of the Lifeway Leadership Podcast Network. And I want to ask if you've listened to the New Church's Q&A podcast yet, the one co-hosted by Daniel M., Todd Atkins, and Ed Stetzer. They're a part of our Lifeway Leadership Podcast Network family, and they've recently talked about how to handle MLMs in your church. Do you know what that is, Brian?
No.
Yeah, I don't either.
I'm just keeping it real.
I'll have to tune in because I'm not sure what that is.
That's a good reason to tune in, though.
It is. If a non-type A personality can succeed in church planting and multi-site versus church plants, that's a good. I actually listened to that episode. Ed's got some good points. They're not all right. I don't agree all the time with Ed, but he's got some good points.
You don't
one.
Agree all the time with Ed Stetzer.
No.
Okay.
And he calls us the Surratt Mafia. So I have
He
started that, yeah. So just look up New Church's Q&A on your favorite podcasting app and subscribe today.
Well,
or tomorrow.
Yeah.
Either one would probably work.
I think all the podcasts on the network are particularly strong. When you get this group of this threesome together, that's going to be pretty dynamic.
It's amazing.
And Ed is one of the wonderful communicators, I think, in evangelicalism today. And, you know, he's very well studied and very well researched. And, you know, like Chris, you know, may not always agree, but it's never boring. That's for sure.
No, it's great.
Well, that's going to wrap it up for episode 84. I'd like to thank you again, Tony Morita. And Tony, I just want you to know our group is actually doing your Ephesians study, Ephesians, Your Identity in Christ now. And it's been out now for maybe about a year and a half. There is also a student version that has gotten a lot of traction with students, with the churches, when they're student ministries. And Tony, I think you've had lots of people, or a great number of people, even mention that to you, right?
Yeah, one quick funny story. My son went to a different youth group one Sunday night, and he had no idea what they were studying, and it was my video. So he shows up, and his dad is teaching the student Bible study. And so he was like, man, if you like him, you should come to our church. He preaches three times that long.
So did he raise his hand at any point and say, I've heard this before, can I go now?
they had no idea, because my son's adopted from Ethiopia, the one I'm talking about, Joshua. So, you know, he's darker than I am. And so they just popped this video in. He's like, that's my dad.
Well, thanks for being with us, Tony. And we would recommend the Ephesians study. You might also want to check out the Acts 29 podcast that Tony co-hosts. This is Brian Daniel for Chris Surratt, and again with Dr. Tony Morita. And that's going to do it for episode 84. Remember, hang on. Spring is just around the corner.